Yeah, a lot of times, probably three-fourths of the time, he just forgave whatever bill there would have been to people because they couldn't pay. And this was before the Depression. He just did that because he had this gift, this knack, along with his medical training. I don't know if it was that extent. I forget. But, you know, to help people, you know, with bones and things like that. So hence the name Bone Setter Reese. But pretty neat stuff. And so I'd like to hear about stuff like that. I think it's relevant to the whole thing about healthcare insurance and, you know, how you know, you've taken it out of the one-to-one combination where a doctor can have that discretion to do that.
Right.
You know, doctors don't want to gouge people. I think, you know, the ones that really go into it for the, you know, correct reasons, and I think most of them do. But, you know, they need to make a living for all the money they put out. It's like a 15-year commitment now to become a doctor.
It is, not only for their education, but the insurance they have to carry on top of that and the staff they pay and everything. Yeah.
So they're just asking, you know, that message doesn't get out there. You know, doctors aren't out there to gouge people. It's just they've made quite an investment, you know, if you look at it that way, and what they ongoingly have to pay, as you say, for medical insurance. But anyway, I digress there. Just had to throw that in. That is so interesting. So you're going through all that. That oral history to see if there's some stuff that's relevant.
Then I'll take those little snippets and I'll, you know, cut them down to whatever is relevant to that exhibit, and that will be connected again through the QR code. So you can go to that 1905 doctor's office, and next to it will have the code, and I'll have a little bio about the guy that did the oral history, and then you can hear what he has to say about what he remembers of his first office in 1920.
Wow. That's neat. Maybe you'll find something about the x-ray machine where he says, that dagnabbit machine. What the heck, they bring these newfangled things in here.
We do have an oral history from a radiologist, so I do have some clips from him that I'll be incorporating into that museum, or to that exhibit,
That's neat.
So, and we have nurses, too. There was a project that did interview doctors, and then there was another project that interviewed nurses from the Youngstown Hospital Association.
Glad to hear that. Glad to hear that, because a lot of times, most of the people really end up relating to the nurse. The doctor's busy. We understand that. They come in, and the doctor could be a man, too, you know, whatever. I'm talking about the professions here. Generally, the nurse is the one that has the hands-on with the patient, so they're the one that dispenses the information or the good stuff. But talk about that. We talked about the nurses. I'm glad to hear they were interviewed too for their memories of the most difficult patient, or if they waited on someone or cared for someone who was famous, like, I don't know, Cary Grant. Maybe he was coming through Youngstown one day and he caught a cold and he had to go to St. Elizabeth's to get some help.
You know, I haven't heard about that yet.
Nothing like that?
No.
Okay. I'm just looking for, you know, thinking of quirky things. But talk about, you were talking about, you have on display at the museum some of the nurses' uniforms, which I thought sounded pretty neat, fashionable.
People love those. They're very nice uniforms. We have some from the Youngstown Hospital Association School of Nursing, and then also St. Elizabeth's School of Nursing. The Youngstown Hospital Association ones are a light blue. They go down to the knee, and they're short-sleeved, and they have these very sharp-looking white cuffs on the sleeves. And then on the left sleeve, the woman's name would be embroidered on her left sleeve.
Wow.
And then they have sharp, very crisp white aprons that go over the blue dress.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, of course, a white cap and black stockings and black shoes.
Wow.
And then the St. Elizabeth's one.
Are those fishnet stockings?
No, would not be.
Okay, just black stockings. Okay.
Opaque black stockings.
Opaque, gotcha.
The St. Elizabeth's ones are very similar with the white apron, but their dress underneath is a blue and white check.
Wow. You said you thought that just sounds really smart, really attractive, those uniforms.
I mean, when you compare them to what the nurses wear today with the scrubs that they wear and the tennis shoes, and I'm sure that's way more practical.
Oh,
if you're doing a 12-hour shift, you don't want to be in a dress that has to be starched and ironed every day.
And what time, do you have the, like, circa the dates when those uniforms would have been used, like from 1922 to 50?
The ones we have are from 1956, you know, the late 50s, most of them.
That's neat. I know. My sister-in-law is a nurse. I'm going to have to tell her to come down to the Melnick Museum.
Mm-hmm.
You know? She went to St. Elizabeth's Nursing School in the 60s.
Okay.
So that's when you got like a 3-year degree right from the school there. It wasn't a bachelor's degree.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like a BS in nursing.
It was really, yeah. From 1960 to 1980 was a great transition for nursing education here in the United States, where the hospitals started realizing that the cost to run these schools was just too much.
Yeah.
And as nursing became much more technical, they turned over some of the coursework to colleges, community colleges and local schools that could do that. And then they just provided the hands-on, the ward training for the older students. Mm-hmm. So that's, there was a statistic, I think there were 900 hospital-based training schools for nurses in 1960. Mm-hmm. And by 1980, there were less than 300.
Wow, lost two-thirds. Mm-hmm.
And then you see the reverse line is the associate's and bachelor's degree programs that were building at the exact same time from colleges.
Yeah, it seemed like it was an orderly transition. They knew that, you know, they couldn't do it anymore. The hospitals, because of the financial concerns.
Yeah, I think insurance companies started, health insurance companies paid the hospital bills differently. Mm. They could no longer cover a little bit of the cost to support the nursing school. And a lot of those nursing schools had dormitories for the women.
Yep.
So you've got all that staff that
yes.
you've got for that. And also nurses needed to be in the classroom more and doing less work. Mm. Originally when those kinds of programs started, the hospital got a lot of labor out of those schools. The student nurses would work long hours in the hospital in the ward.
Yeah, kind of like what interns do in becoming a doctor, right? They mm-hmm. get abused.
Yeah, definitely.
Don't they? I mean, abused in a sense that they work like, what, two days in a row?
Sometimes
call.
More, yeah. They're on call a lot.
Yeah.
And that's how the student nurses were treated in the beginning. They were, they worked a 12-hour shift and they got one lecture a week in 1912. That was their education. And they did that for 2 years and then that was it. You were considered a nurse.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
You worked 12 hours?
Every day. And then you got one lecture a week in the evening.
Oh, you did that for
2 years.
By a doctor.
And then not like somebody who was trained to teach.
No.
By a doctor who did whatever specialty you were learning about.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the 1920s, there was no government regulation. There was no association, no test that you took to become a registered nurse.
No.
That didn't happen until 1950.
Okay.
So before that, it was just state tests, so it depended on what state you were in. And if your state didn't have an organized test, you could go through any program you wanted and, you would be qualified to be a nurse.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting, the history of that alone.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, talking about how that's evolved and in any profession, how it's come to this point in standardized testing where we have some, common ground
mm-hmm.
to know if somebody, can travel around and, is able to do their profession. Let me ask you this. Did Youngstown, would you know this in your studies or the Melnick Museum, have we ever had a medical school? For doctors.
Yeah, not to my knowledge. No,
no
they all
I don't
go
think
to
so
Cleveland.
Either. We had a law school. We had a law school in Youngstown. But
no,
I wonder why not. I wonder why, some of our industrialists at the turn of the century, only out of civic pride and like, why don't we have a medical school? something like that. Let's do one.
Yeah, I don't know.
Okay.
That is really
now, I mentioned Bonesetter Reese. Do you have anything from him or his family?
We do have a wall in the museum that's dedicated to local history. So it's got photographs of many of the early hospitals in the Mahoning Valley.
Mm-hmm.
It also details some of the military work that the doctors and nurses have done. And then the Red Cross chapters of Trumbull and Mahoning County.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a wall that has photographs of early doctors and a little bit of biographical information about them.
Okay.
And I believe Bonesetter Reese is on that wall.
Really? I thought maybe you would have got an examining table from him or,
mm-hmm.
or something from, because he was right over here on Park Avenue on the north side of Youngstown.
To my knowledge, I don't think we have anything artifact-wise contributed to him.
Yeah, I would hope. I don't know if there's a good... I'm not sure about the children. I can't remember if there were that, they're living on that,
mm-hmm.
Would make a contribution to the museum. Because he was, in the 20s, 30s, probably made it to the 50s, I think. might have passed away in the 50s.
Yeah, I think that sounds right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But anyway, some of the other things, that, but you're working on that where, you know, someone, if they come in, they could hear it, you know, with a smartphone, you're saying?
Right.
Is there anything like where there's like these things that you're going through, the reminiscences by the doctors and the nurses? Is that available like on a cassette or a disc or something, like if somebody wanted to hear that was...
They have been digitized. And like I said, I'm part of the university library and archives.
Okay.
The university archives has a digital repository online where we store digital versions of documents that we have.
Okay.
Photographs or scanned records. And I believe that we are in the process of putting those oral histories online.
Okay. They could do that right at the museum. Right, you could access that and listen to if it's on.
Yes, and you can even do that from home,
yeah,
too.